Welcome to this week's Made in Scotland podcast, sponsored by Ogilvy Ross. I'm Gary Robinson. This week's guest has a very varied CV. Ended his military career as a major, director of operations for the British and Irish Lions, first professional team manager of the Scottish national rugby team, amongst other things, and now founder and CEO, rather, of Iger Performance, which is all about leadership. You do some inspirational public speaking. You motivate people to within an inch of their lives. Guy Richardson, welcome to Made in Scotland.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm delighted to be here, Gary.
Guy, it's great. Absolutely great. Do you know, I go through my guests' biographies, as you would imagine, a lot, and I don't like to dwell too much on any particular part. But for one so young, not a bad old career so far.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah. You joined the army early on. You followed in your father's footsteps, I believe.
Yep, I followed my father's footsteps. Decided to go to Sandhurst at the age of 18 and came out of Sandhurst in 1985 as a young second lieutenant with a shiny one pip on my shoulder.
And are you a Scot by birth?
Not by birth. I was born in Tidworth in Surrey, but I very much see myself as a Scot and been lucky enough to fight within a Scottish regiment in the Royal Scots, and I've been lucky enough also to play for Scottish schoolboys, so I very much see myself as Scottish.
Me too, adopted.
Good man.
And I love it. And your father was quite senior in the military as well, wasn't he?
He was. My father came from, my grandfather was a publican down in Leith, and my father came from Leith and joined the army as a private soldier and was very successful and then became knighted as a general. Yeah, so I'm very proud of him.
And Sandringham,
Sandhurst.
I'm thinking wrong venue. I imagine was quite an institution to join, quite a formidable foreboding.
It is formidable. I mean, it's, you know, it is one of the top military academies in the world. It's all about educating, and I stress that, educating and providing the tools for people to go on and then subsequently develop themselves within the British Army to become leaders. It doesn't turn you into a leader. You don't come out of Sandhurst knowing everything. In fact, it's really important that you adapt those tools to your environment and, of course, listen to the wise old owls that are out there. And often it's said that what makes a good officer is his first platoon sergeant.
I'm sure you learned an awful lot there, but what was the biggest lesson that you learned while you were there? Is there anything that stands out?
I think the biggest thing for me was you have to be at the top of your game. You have to absolutely know your business. You have to be fit, and you have to be prepared to cross the road to help people all the time. And I think collaboration was the key for me, and I think I would say that was probably it. You know, and you are put in a position whereby you are privileged to lead soldiers in war, and that is a big responsibility. And the motto for Sandhurst is "Serve to Lead," and I think that is absolutely right.
Was there a high dropout rate there?
I did an initial course called Rowell & Company, which was for those people who didn't quite have it, as they say. I don't know how they put it, but there was a sort of grey area. Has he got it? Has he not got it? So I went on this course, started as a pre-course, which actually takes place at Sandhurst. They stopped it now. And started with 85 and finished with 24. And I have to say, I think if I reflect back on that, there were some good people who I think would have gone on to be very good officers who were lost on that course. It was an absolute beasting, really. And you were put through the ringer, both mentally and physically. And I just think on a couple of occasions, I thought we were losing some good people there. Yeah, but that aside, I think it's an excellent course and prepares people not only to be leaders in the army, but also leaders in life. And it was interesting that I was back at Sandhurst speaking recently to some of the officer cadets, and I was talking about that very subject.
And prior to you joining and going to Sandhurst, was that something that your father encouraged, or were you quite independently minded and you went, "Nah, I'd love to do this, I want to do it," or were you slightly cajoled?
Yeah, I'm the youngest of four children, and we were brought up in two pairs. My immediate brother is 18 months older, and then I've got six years to the day. We share the same birthday, 6 year older brother, and then a 9 year older sister. At no point, actually, quite the opposite. You know, one would think that I would be pressured to join the army, and none of it. Actually, quite the opposite. My dad was very clear on, you know, you must do something you enjoy. At one point, I was looking at going to do PE, physical education. But what I decided to do was I wanted to do something that was going to challenge me physically and stretch me mentally. And I thought that the army was right for that.
And was the love of sport prior as well to the army, or was that something that came with the whole army package?
Yeah.
You know, your love of rugby and so on.
I think when one reflects back at school, and you reflect back on what things you enjoyed, and they're often things that you were good at. And I was pretty good at sport at school. I'm not very academic. I always struggled with academia. I used to work really hard. I found it quite unfair, but I just didn't really get the results. So my love of sport has always been there, really. And it was something that I was good at, and it was something that I turned to and got great enjoyment out of. Yeah.
I want to stay on leadership, because actually looking at your very impressive CV, Guy, you know, it's everywhere. It's absolutely everywhere. And I've heard you speak a few times, and it's a great line you have. And you talk about there is an assumption that people think it is easy to lead in an organization like the army because people have to do as they're told. I don't want to steal your lines, but I've never thought of it like that. But you tell me it's the complete opposite.
I think it is. I think I call it the misperception. I did 20 years in the military. I'm a huge fan of it. It was a huge privilege, and it shaped me who I am today. But I do think it's a misperception that's out there. And I've been out now for 13, 14 years. And I think people do think that it's easy because you just tell them what to do. Well, if you've got a 15-stone hairy jock, you know, who comes from wherever he comes from, you know, and you are expecting, and you're putting he is putting his life in your hands. If he doesn't respect you and he thinks you're a bit of a muppet, he's just simply not going to follow you. And it's quite the opposite. You've got to really work hard at the respect bit, and you really be very careful and be very clear on what you're doing before you make decisions. And I'll give you a very quick example. You know, we talked about Sandhurst previously, and I recall an individual who was not in my regiment, but he left at the same time as me. And within 6 months of leaving, and indeed, you know, the investment that was put into his education at Sandhurst, he was thrown out the army. And he was thrown out the army because he was a bit of a muppet, because he assumed that he was now a good leader and everyone must follow him, and he was dictatorial. Well, actually, you have to be collaborative, and you have to bring people along with you. And I think, you know, I think it's a great thing putting your hand up. Now, irrespective if you are running a multi-billion pound company or not, if you don't know the answer to a question and you're not sure, put your hand up and say, "Listen, what do you think, guys and girls? Because I'm not sure about this." It just helps massively with the respect, but I think.
So when did the professional career turn to sport? You left the army, major up there. Mm. When did the professional sporting opportunities come along?
Well, I decided. I joined the army as a single guy who used to sit on the toilet and read Commando magazines, and think one day that would be fantastic. I mean, really, that's really what it's all about, mucking about. And I joined the army as a single guy, had a fantastic time, was in Germany a lot during the Cold War, went on numerous operations, and then I got married, a wonderful family. I then have two wonderful boys. But there comes a point where the army was changing, it was shrinking, and therefore commitments were increasing, foreign abroad commitments were increasing. And with three consecutive Christmases away from my family, I thought, really, this is not for me. And I took that decision and around about 2000. And in 2004, I left 4 years later, and I put in place a plan to leave. And I was very methodical about it, and looked into all sorts of options, because you have a wide skill set, and your left of arc, you know, you could your band with which you can contribute to the world is massive in terms of what jobs you can do. Anyway, it so happens that I was reading. I had lined up. It's the old story, isn't it? You line up a number of jobs. I had a number of jobs lined up. It's like waiting for a bus. And then I was reading the paper one morning. I remember it to this day. It was a Scotsman, and there was a picture of Chris Patterson, who was captain of Scotland at the time. And Scotland had just been defeated at the weekend, and his head was in his hands. And I was reading the article, and I noted in the article that a chap called Dougie Morgan was leaving his post as the team manager of Scotland.
As a consequence of the loss, or was
no?
This...
No, it was just moving on. He's a cropodist, and he was an amateur player who played for Scotland. Very good player. He was a scrum half, and I looked at that and I thought, I could do that. So in parallel with all these other jobs that I was potentially lining up, I then set about with my network trying to land this job. And anyway, the long and the short of it is I landed that job through connections I had. I then went for a couple of interviews, and I then became the first professional team manager of the Scotland rugby team, which was a huge privilege.
You make it sound that journey incredibly easy, and I'm sure it wasn't. How dogged do you have to be in order to get from A to B on that? Because, you know, it's not just a case, is it, of finding a few people.
You're remembering what I told you the other day, aren't you?
I do listen.
So dogged determination is one of my top five key qualities of a leader. I think you have to have dogged determination. That, you know, the road in life is just not straight, is it? It's bends, it's twists. You need to get some rope on to go down in somewhere, and you get your crampons on to go. That's just the way it is. And I think you have to be dogged. And I think so to answer your question, you have to be very dogged, I think, in life, particularly if you want to get to something. And you know, sometimes, you know, there is requirement to compromise. But I think the very good leaders in life have a dogged determination. It's something that I've always been brought up with to have.
Stubborn.
Yeah, I think stubborn. It could be sometimes when I'm doing stuff, it could be stubborn. I think one of my family traits is we could be perceived as being stubborn. Yeah.
Or incredibly focused.
Stubborn and focused.
If we're putting a PR spin on this.
Stubborn and focused.
I love it. One thing that I'm fascinated about is how leaders, and they're all individuals, including yourself, how do leaders keep themselves at the very top of their game? Because we're all human, we all have bad days, we all have times where we just want to shut the door, or somebody comes in and asks us a question and we want to be quite blunt with the answer, but we can't be because we're in that, you know, we're in that position of seniority. What does it for you? How do you keep yourself up there? How do you keep that consistency of leadership?
Yeah, I'm going to answer that in two parts. I think sometimes you can be blunt. So to say that you can't be blunt as a leader, I think is incorrect. I think there are times where people pontificate around and dance around, you know, it might be a diversity issue or whatever. I mean, sometimes you've just got to be blunt in life and say what needs to be said. And that comes down to a bit of moral courage to say what needs to be said. The second thing is, I think, to answer your question, I think leadership is, as a matter of fact, it is lonely. And I think what keeps people, good leaders, focused and being able to continually deliver at the level that they are doing so is that they have a mentor, somebody that they can share their concerns with. I think you'll find very few leaders out there who don't have a mentor or somebody that they can share their thoughts with. because we are only human. And if you sit in a bubble all your life, you know, you become very lonely. And actually, some of the decisions you subsequently make are not really attributed to the wider cause.
And we will divert back to leadership, but I just want to keep in the world of rugby just for the moment, because we talked about, you know, you being the first professional team manager of the Scottish national rugby team. Did the director of ops for the British Lions, British and Irish Lions, follow that thereafter?
It did, yeah, it did.
And was that another, oh, right, I fancy that? Or were you headhunted, or did you just go?
It was another.
Did you phone a few folks?
No, it was another, I fancy that. So, just to go back, you know, in the army, you change jobs every 2 years, you know. And that's, in many ways, that's a very good thing because you do so many jobs. So the higher you go up, you're dealing with people that you have done their job, so you can relate to what they're saying. So it's a very good system, I think. I then joined Scottish Rugby, and then I'm doing the same job for 6 years. And I'm developing it, and you know, being lucky enough to be the first professional manager, I had a pretty blank piece of paper, and I could develop the job spec appropriately. But I did get a little bit, I looked to what next. And of course, at the top of the tree in terms of rugby globally is the British and Irish Lions, you know, in terms of, you know, the best of Scotland, England, Ireland and Wales. So I get in touch with the chief executive. The year is 2008. And he says to me, beginning of 2008, ahead of them touring South Africa in 2009, and he says to me, sorry, Guy, I've just given the role to Louise Ramsey. Louise Ramsey is a fantastic operational manager. She was Clive Woodward's manager for the Rugby World Cup in 2003. I get on extremely well with her, and she's hugely competent in what she does. I have huge respect for her. So I then thought, thanks very much, but I'm not going to stop there. So I then did a gap analysis on the tour. I looked and saw who they were taking in terms of, not individuals, but in terms of posts. Saw they were moving so often. And I then related my thoughts to the army. And when you move a lot in the army, you send forward a recce party. And of course, the recce party facilitates the main body coming in. And you then become combat ready, to use a military term, much quicker than you had you not put a recce party forward. So I thought, well, how about this? How about I become the recce guy for the Lions? They move 11 times over a tour. I'll go forward. I'll square all the rooms away in the hotel. I'll make sure everything's in place. So literally, you come off the bus, and I can save them 5 to 6 hours in terms of setup. Prepared a job spec. I put it together, a one-pager. I got in front of Ian McGeachan, who was the coach for the 2009 Lions tour. And it was that classic, my aim in the next 5 minutes is to convince you. And I gave him my pitch. And then he said, thanks very much, Guy. I'll let you know. And then 3 months later, he got in touch with me and said, do you want to come on the Lions tour? So I went on the Lions tour as a logistics manager. And the aim was always to get the big role. So that draw was, quite frankly, doing my sleep and not disrespecting either the Lions or the role. But the plan was do that, do it well, and do all the add-ons to it with a view to people offering me the bigger job. And that's what happened. So at the end of the last 2009, they said, would I be interested in going on 2013 tour in the greater role? And that's exactly what I did, resigning from the Scottish Rugby Union in 2010.
You told a story at a conference recently, and you may not want to repeat it, and I would absolutely respect that. But you told a story about dressing room morale and about how you led by example, which I thought was a fantastic story. No name, no pack drill, of course, but even if you're willing to share that, I think other people would find that really interesting as well.
Yeah, this was... this was when I went into the Scotland rugby team, and through no fault of their own, I think, you know, the setup had the players absolutely through no fault of their own had just lost their way a little bit, and that's not disrespecting anybody. And I think, you know, as professional players, they were not necessarily respecting the surroundings as much as they could have done. And I think if they were in the room here today with us, and I get on extremely well with them all, I think they'd probably agree with me. And as part of the change management system we were putting in place as a management team, one of the small things that was happening was just a small thing, like the changing room was being left in a real state after training. Some of the training kit was going missing, not being properly accounted for. So what I decided to do was the best thing, bearing in mind that I'd come from a military background and therefore there was always the danger that people would think I'd be very dictatorial, so I had to keep that in mind. So what I decided to do was, of an evening when they came in from training, put lots of bins around on the floor of the changing room, and then I would set about, once they came in and they were throwing stuff on the floor and not into the bin, not all of them, I might add, I would make a point of picking it up, asking them to move their feet politely and put it in the bin. Mm-hmm. And then I would brush the floor, and they were all looking at me. And there's me, aged whatever, doesn't matter, irrespective of age, I was whatever I was, 39 at the time. And on day three, one of the senior players said to me, "Give me the brush guy." And that was the pivotal moment for the players being empowered and taking responsibility for their actions and respecting the changing room. And that was really the catalyst of change. And we really used that to change lots of other areas and empower the players.
I thought it was a great story because I think it's incredibly transferable to business.
Mm.
So, you know, if you have a leader, a boss, a gaffer, whatever you want to call them, and they have that dictatorial culture and wouldn't necessarily do that, sweeping the floors, picking up the dirty socks, it's going to be incredibly difficult to change hearts and minds within either a dressing room or within an organisation.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, I often say to people, you know, and if you're speaking to a group of people, whatever business, whatever the subject, and you're asking them to do something, if you know your people, you can tell on their faces if they think you're barking or not, asking them to do something. There's a fact. And if you're looking at them and you sense that there is a question mark over what you are asking them to do, here's something. Do it yourself. It has to be that. I think irrespective of who you are, how old you are, male or female, it doesn't matter. And I think by doing that, you know, it's only going to be a positive outcome.
I love that story. And I believe it's transferable. I want to go back to a couple of things you said earlier.
Sure.
About telling it straight and being very honest and, you know, not beating around the bush, words to that effect. Has that got you into trouble?
Absolutely has. You know, I think sometimes, and I've learned over the years, you know, I wear my heart on my sleeve, and I'm very passionate about certain things, leadership being one of them, quality of service being another. And I think that if I'm not happy about something, I'll say it. But what I've learned to do over the years is I tend to check myself now and ask myself a question. Am I saying something for the sake of saying it to get off my chest? Or am I saying it because I genuinely believe it's going to make a difference? And if I think it's generally going to make a difference to the greater good of what we're trying to achieve as a team, I'll say it.
Can you give me an example of where it's bitten you right on the backside?
Oh, quality stuff. Quality question. Where has it really bitten me badly? It's bitten me very badly when I was a company commander in the army, responsible for about 150 people, and my commanding officer, who I reported into, who was responsible for 500 people and the welfare of, I fundamentally did not agree with something, and I just kept on at him about it. And you know, in a group scenario, which is never good to do, good to undermine somebody in a group, but I then subsequently went to his office afterwards and just kept on going. And I remember the immortal words that came out of, "Guy, there's only going to be one winner out of this, and it's not you." That's what he said. But I, you know, I still to this day feel that I was saying the right thing. And you know. Yeah, so that was one occasion.
Because it can. We love people talking from the heart and telling it as it is, but it can, if you're not careful, you know, do bite you on the backside. But I do also think that you cannot closet people. So, for instance, there will be people who are managers, senior managers, potential managers listening to this podcast, but you know, there's that age-old time where, you know, the board will say to you, you need to look at efficiencies. Now, we all know what efficiencies mean. Mm. Just say the word redundancies or letting people go. Yeah. But you can't closet people from that. You've got to be very, very direct and clear. Because actually, if you try and closet people from the harsh truth of what's about to happen, you can actually do them more damage than being honest and straightforward, I imagine.
But absolutely. But surely the poor leader... If somebody is made redundant suddenly because they are not delivering and they didn't expect it, surely that is as a result of poor leadership for me. You know,
further up 100%, the pecking order.
No question about it. I think, you know, if you are open, honest, and know your team, have KPIs in place, whatever system you have in place with your HR department, review process. You know, if people are not delivering to a certain point and they know it, they know they're going to be on the cosh. And if you give them every opportunity to deliver and they still don't deliver at the level they're going, quite frankly, they're expecting it, are they not? Disappointed as they will be, nobody likes to sack people. But I agree with you. Suddenly people are asked to make costs reduction, and you know suddenly some people will be made redundant. But you know, if I'm in charge of five people, I'd like to think that I know who my top five, you know, what the order of people I want to keep is.
Oh, what would you look for in people? Who would you like in that five in terms of their leadership traits and personalities?
I think the most important thing for me is integrity. And what does that mean? C.S. Lewis said words to this effect. He said, integrity is what you do when nobody is watching. You know, and so that's it, isn't it? You know, if you are honest to yourself and honest to other people, I think integrity is what I seek most in people. I think that's really, really important. I also... look for loyalty. You know, I've come from a military background where loyalty is so intertwined in what we do. And I think when one is bounding around words like loyalty and trust, one needs to be very careful and ensure that whoever you're talking to, they are on the same wavelength as you, because as I've learned myself through mistakes I've made. Yes, you know, and I think that's the best way to learn. You know, I'm in my third year of my business. I've made mistakes, and a lot of my mistakes have been through trusting people, thinking that I have their trust. But actually, my interpretation of trust is clearly very different to theirs. Yeah. And, you know, if I'm now trusting people, I'm saying to them, listen, just so you know, if I'm trusting you, this is what it means to me. What does it mean to you? And I find by just being a bit more open and honest about that, it seems to make a bit of a difference.
Once again, listening to your talk, and I questioned you on this as well. You go so, and forgive me, I'm making assumptions here, but my interpretation of what you said was, I go into every situation expecting that I will win. Mm. Did I pick that up right?
When I was in the military, and we went on operational service, at no stage did I ever contemplate that we were going to lose.
Do you feel like that about business?
It's a really good question. I think the fact that I went, I think the answer is probably no.
Okay.
You know, and then you say to yourself, well, why is that? And I think when we went on operations in the military, irrespective of where it was, the training that we were put through was just immense. Every possible scenario you could think of as an individual, as a team, as a platoon, whatever the scenario was you were put through, very realistic. And dare I say, and very sadly, you know, on occasions we people were killed in training as a result of making it as near as damn it as you can to the real event. And these, of course, are the people that one thinks about when you have remembrance every year, you know.
You're a very, very positive person, you know, and I encourage anybody to go and see you talk, particularly around leadership. You're not exactly demure, and which is a great thing. But there must have been, Guy, and I've asked this question of all my guests, there must have been a time where you were taken into a pretty dark place because you're a human, like us all.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Would you be willing to share an example, and how did you get through the other end?
So I'm just losing a bit here. I think the dark places for me are, I come from a very close family. I was very lucky to have a lovely childhood, and you know, I think losing my parents was always a difficult one for me, you know. I lost my mum when I was 20, and that was really difficult. That was 30 years ago, actually, in 1986, and she died suddenly of cancer. And I mean, I'm sure everybody goes through this difficulty, you know, but I think the dark places for me in my life has been that. And how have I dealt with it? You know, I dealt with my mum's death by just going straight back into being very busy. It was a real shock, but I was 20. It was 3 days before my 21st birthday. You know, it was a very difficult time. But you know, the strength of the team I had around me and my friends really, really helped me. My dad died recently, 2 years ago. He had a wonderful life. You know, he'd come to the end of his life. You know, he was 85 and died in the middle of the night. And the shock, though that was, he had a great life. And so I'm very grateful for that. But I think those are the dark places for me. And I think, you know, if you're a close family and you lose family members, that's a very difficult time.
And I see a book just by your side there, which takes me to my, just a few more questions about a book that you think could possibly change somebody's life, or perhaps has changed yours, Guy, in some sort of way.
Yeah, thanks for that. I'm not someone who reads a lot of books, if I'm being honest, which is a real shame. You know, if I have a regret, it's I wish I had the inkling to read more, but I don't. I have lots of books next to my bed, half read. But I do find the likes of the social media really good for reading articles and so on. It's probably my attention span more than anything else, which actually comes to probably why I like this book. So this is a book. It's a quotation book. It's called Warrior's Words, and it's from a chap called Peter Soros, and it refers to about 150 military people, or quotes from about 150 military people, covering a span, would you believe it, of 4,000 years. And in the index of it, if you could think of anything that you'd like to sort of get inspirational words from, you just look up the word. You look up the word and then look to the respective page. And I'll give you an example. You know. Under A, it's got ability, action, activity, adaptiveness, administration, advancement. A lot of these are military terms, but I just wanted to share, because this is about, we're talking a bit about leadership, I wanted to share with you under the leadership chapter and read to you, if I may, a quote by Captain Sir Basil Little Heart, and it's comes from his book Thoughts on War in 1944. Can I read that?
Yes, please do. Please do.
And he said the following: the quality of leadership needs, above all, spirit, intelligence, and sympathy. Spirit is needed to fire men to self-sacrificing achievements. Intelligence, because men will only respect and follow a leader whom they feel knows his profession thoroughly. Sympathy, to understand the mentality of each individual in order to draw out the best that is in him. Given these qualities, men will conquer fear to follow a leader.
It's a wonderful way to almost end, because it answers a question that I had about, you know, that bit of advice, you know, for the next potential leader. I don't think you can get much better than that. Guy Richardson, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you, as always. What I'd like you to do before you announce your choice of song, the name of the artist and the song, well, this is where you get to do your DJ bit, of course, with those wonderful dulcet tones of yours. Tell me a little bit, share with the listener why this means so much to you, this song.
This song came at a time when it was the next chapter of my life. I was 19. I just left school. I just had a really good year, you know, mucking about, doing stuff that you do when you're 18. And I was just about to go to Sandhurst, and I felt on top of the world.
And it's as simple as that.
It's as simple as that. It's as simple as that. And funnily enough, you know, I have a 19-year-old son now who is exactly in that position now. He's just starting university. And it's a very vibrant song, and it brings, you know, there's two ways of looking at songs, I think. One gets very pulled into some of the words of the songs, and I love this song because of the words. Others love songs because, not necessarily the words, because it takes them back to a wonderful place. And the one that I've chosen takes me back to a wonderful time in my life when I was embarking on my next stage of my career and going into the army.
And the song is?
The year is 1984. It's Phil Collins, and it's Sussudio.
The Made in Scotland podcast, sponsored by Ogilvy Ross, was produced by Chris Kidd for Gardine Studios and GRC.